talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Good afternoon, Britain. Welcome all around the world. I'm Alan Miller and it's great to be with you today. Well, what a week we've had this week. We've had political leaders, some arrested, like in Scotland, and we've had political leaders taken to court, like we've seen in the States. We've had a leader in New Zealand who seems flummoxed, not able to say what a woman is, and we've had much more else. We've had a continuation of the challenges and impositions and restrictions in the UK, known as the ULEZ expansion. The discussion around that is continuing, as are the low traffic neighbourhood impositions and the fact that it looks like Oxford County Council has bought lots of cameras to implement, to survey all of the residents and businesses that have said they don't want low traffic neighbourhoods. More from campaigning around the country in the second part of the show. But in the top part of the show, I'm really pleased to welcome someone who has made an indelible mark on the discussion around how we responded to COVID, how we should have responded from a rational, evidence-based position. Someone that has an enormous amount of experience and also was one of the co-founders of the Great Barrington Declaration. It is, of course, Professor Jay Bhattacharya, who's Professor of Health Policy at Stanford University and also Director of the Center of the Demography and Economics of Health and Aging. Jay, welcome to the show today.
So good to be here, Alan. Thanks for having me.
And I should tell everyone that it's 4 a.m. where Jay is, so he's absolutely done a huge solid and come on and got up early to speak with us. Jay, I mean, so much has happened, and with the Twitter files, you know, anyone who maybe did not know about what was going on, many of them, almost everyone will now know, but certainly many more people, the kind of censoring and blacklisting that happened to you and to other doctors and journalists and citizens, as well as kind of spy units we had in Britain and in the States, treating us as though we're enemy combatants almost. Just before we get into all of that, because it's been huge news, just tell me a little bit how, when the COVID first started, what your response was to how leaders were beginning to deal with it in the States to begin with, just having knowing what was going on in China and where. Let's bring us back to that moment, and then what changed and what happened with you. Just set some context for us, please.
So, Alan, when COVID started, I was just a professor. I published papers. I was pretty happy with my life. I you know, taught students. I had this hypothesis that there was going to be that the disease was much more widespread than people realized, because I'd been writing about infectious disease epidemiology for a long time. I watched what happened during the swine flu epidemic. And there was an initial panic that looked very much like the initial panic with COVID during the swine flu time. The World Health Organization said it was going to be 3%, 4%, 5% or more mortality from the swine flu. But there were a series of studies checking the antibody levels in the population at large. What turned out to be the case with swine flu was that there was 100 times more people that had been infected than public health officials realized. And the mortality rate turned out to be very low, 0.01%, you know, one in 10,000. It basically dissolved the panic. So I wrote an op-ed, the first op-ed I'd ever written in my life, published in the Wall Street Journal, just putting forward this hypothesis that we don't know yet how widespread COVID is, in March of 2020, almost 3 years ago, just a little over 3 years ago to date. Then I ran a study, the seroprevalence study, that very early in the pandemic, that found that the death rate, this is, again, I think it's almost a year, 3 years ago to this date, we finished the data collection for it. And we found that in California, that 4% of LA County and 3% of Santa Clara County, where I live, I had Los Angeles County and Santa Clara County, had already had COVID in early April 2020. That meant the death rate was 0.2%, not 3% or 4% like the World Health Organization was saying. I published the study thinking it was just normal science that it would change people's minds because now the disease is much, we're not able to contain it, which has obviously been proved true. The other implication of this study was that it was going to be very difficult to stop the disease from spreading basically everywhere. We should focus our attention on protecting vulnerable people. But instead of this being met with like what I would expect to be normal science, I just started getting death threats. I started getting you know, hate mail. My friends, some of my old friends at Stanford University where I work, defriended me on Facebook. It was a very strange time because people didn't want to hear what the scientific evidence was saying. And that has been a theme that's continued through the whole pandemic.
So, I mean, death threats, what, anonymous death threats or what was that? Wow.
It was just email threats. And I mean, I'm an Indian American. So, you know, I born in India. So there was some racist email. I mean, the whole thing was just, I would just delete them because I figured I just needed to do my job. I didn't have you know, the emotional resources to deal with both doing my job and doing that. So I just deleted them.
And I want to ask you, I mean, this is not necessarily on your expertise, but I mean, why do you think that some people responded like that firstly? And then why do you think your colleagues responded so viscerally? So firstly, why do you think just some people in the public reacted like that?
Well, I think the public has been subject to, I don't know what else to call it. It's a propaganda attack. And it was designed to create fear and panic in the population at large. Initially in 2020, early 2020, that fear and panic mongering, I think by public health and by governments, was designed to make people take COVID more seriously. The fact was that there was a thousandfold difference in the risk of COVID between the old and the young. For the young, it's relatively low risk disease compared to other threats in their lives. For the old, it's a very deadly disease. And I think many public health authorities thought that young people wouldn't take the disease seriously enough, and as a result, the disease would spread. And so they put out a propaganda campaign to make people think, even young people think, that it was a very deadly disease, even for them. And people responded. They responded to that messaging, the fear messaging, and they also responded to this messaging around empathy for others. Right. So if a young person does normal young person things, they'll spread the disease, and older people will die. Grandma will die. And so young people that do normal young people things are going to be responsible for killing their elders. It's a very powerful piece of messaging. So if you have those two pieces of messaging, and then I come along and I say, well, I don't know, the disease is kind of widespread. It's not clear what we can do. It's already spread to 4% of the population. Why don't we focus on protecting vulnerable older people? I mean, people react very viscerally and negatively. They had already made COVID in their mind to be a world historic threat to everybody, when in fact what it was a world historic threat to the old. And so they decided that I was the enemy. My colleagues, many of them were responsible in part for pushing not necessarily the fear mongering, but the idea that we needed to lock down, that this was some kind of huge biosecurity threat or something that was so important that that we'd already locked. I mean, this is April 8th. We'd already locked down for 3 weeks. Schools had closed. Tremendous damage had already been done by the lockdown. The initial lockdowns in India killed 1,000 people who were forced to travel overnight to their home villages. In the United States, that we'd already had, you know, increases in child abuse, depression, all these things were sort of happening when you shut the world down. It was a dramatic thing that scientists themselves had pushed for. And so then, you know, I come along and say, well, gosh, maybe we didn't need to do that because here is the scientific facts about who it harms, who this disease harms, our capacity to control it, and so on. I mean, again, people reacted viscerally and negatively to it.
They did. You said something there that you said that they started off maybe with the intention to let them know how to warn them about it, but then it became something else. Now, intention around all of this has been fiercely debated and questioned. We had a behavioral an insights team in the UK called the Nudge Unit. So basically PsyB, Psychological Behavioral Insights Team, that basically had a whole, as you say, propaganda campaign, but based around getting into people's minds in the most effective way possible and nudging them. But also we had blunt tools like impositions, as you did in the States. But to what extent, in terms of intentions, I know this is a difficult question, but from you having seen and maybe looking at how you'd normally do due diligence, and you said that some of your colleagues, many of your colleagues were responsible for some of the different of those ways of pushing it. What's your takeaway now from intentions about different people, different actors? I mean, obviously there's very many different players here, but what are your thoughts on it?
I mean, I think there is a wide variety of intentions across the board, right? So, I mean, I think, you can look at, let's look at pharmaceutical companies, right? So even there's like mixed intentions, I'd say, right? So many people, actually, I know who work in the pharmaceutical industry, they honestly just wanted to find a treatment or a cure or a vaccine or something for this disease, which was quite deadly. And it is quite deadly for some people. Honest, good intentions, I think. But there were others who wanted to take advantage of the situation to sell their products, even if they're in the absence of evidence, to rush it through regulatory processes. On the public health side, you know, again, I think a mixed set of intentions. Like some people were honestly, they thought of this as a disease that required absolutely extraordinary measures that disrupted the lives of everybody. And they thought, okay, well, these are excessive things in normal times, but these are not normal times. They're people like that. But then there are also people that in public health that, I mean, just to be blunt, their profile within the public health community is raised far beyond what it was once was. I mean, that's a very heady thing. You're like, you know, to like have all of a sudden the scientific community looking at you. The same thing happened with many politicians, right? So like in the United States, there's a governor of New York, Governor Cuomo, who's on TV basically every day looking as if you were, you know, the second coming of FDR, trying to managing a world historic crisis. I mean, I imagine you have the same thing in the UK. You mentioned the Nudge Unit in the UK. It's that essentially that was consisted of behavioral psychologists, behavioral economists, some other people who used psychological techniques to manipulate the population at large. Now, the reason it's called a nudge unit, there was a whole movement in behavioral economics of nudging the population to do the right thing regarding savings, regarding that predates the pandemic. The idea was you change the circumstances a little bit and the people just a tiny bit, nudge. And then people change their behavior as a consequence without even realizing that they made a consequence. So, for instance, like you make a default to saving, your paycheck goes directly into your savings. The default is it goes in, and you have to take the money back out if you want. Rather than the default goes, the money goes to you directly, and then you have to decide to put the money into your savings account. But the Nudge Unit did more than that. The Nudge Unit use psychological techniques to try to manipulate the population into getting public health to do what it wanted. What are the motivations for them? I mean, some of them, they're academic. Okay, we finally get to try our theories out for the first time. But then some are human. You know, oh gosh, we're finally really doing something really, really important that'll save lives. And some are just, you know, power. I think it's always going to be some mix of those kinds of ideas. But I'll tell you, I think once the pandemic, once the fear mongering started, it took on a life of its own and people started doing things that are far outside their normal character.
Yeah. Well, I want to get into this, because many things have happened, and I want to talk about the case that's going on that you've got, that you're taking in terms of Dr. Fauci. I want to look at a bit more about motives and interests and how that all plays out when, you know, people maybe become messianic. Or I mean, but just before we get into that, so then as you launch this and you're there with your peers, I mean, what was the, just before we go to the break, just quickly tell us, what was the temperature at Stanford with your colleagues as you're doing that? Some of them unfriended you, but you're in a place where ideas are meant to be there to be thrashed out. Particularly science has always been about contesting ideas and testing things out. How was it for you when in the early days there?
It was a hostile work environment. Not just my colleagues, but the university official, university administration, treated me as if I was essentially an alien. Although I've been at Stanford for 36 years, but been a professor for over 20 years. It was very difficult to get my work done. At one point, one of the administrators actually ordered within the medical school ordered me to stop appearing in the press, stop commenting, sharing with the public my ideas about an expertise about what I think what the right public health response ought to be. It was a really, really difficult work environment.
Wow. We're going to come back to that. The idea on the academy where ideas are the most important thing should be suffocated and censored. We've seen a lot of that, but that is very chilling. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Jay Bhattacharya. Join us just after this break.
TNT Radio's Katie Hopkins.
We are being perpetually made smaller, that the world is closing down, and we are being taught that we must never try and leave our country. And of course, eventually that will be that we will never try and leave our 15-minute zone. So this story is chaos at Dover, where we get our ferries from when we try and escape to various places like France or Spain. Essentially, there's just enormous backlogs, and by enormous, I mean in excess of 2 days. Easter getaway woes continue for third day after. And they always come up with some bizarre reason. Here we go. Poor weather, long processing times, and then surprising number of vehicles. When does Easter fall? Every year. When does it fall roughly? At the same time. What do we know about Easter holidays? People try and go on holiday. How is it a surprise that there are a lot of people? And if all of these coach companies have booked, which they surely have, and they are ticketed, which they surely are, how is it a surprise when those people that you know are coming turn up?
Katie Hopkins on TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Never forgive, never forget. Punish those who hurt people with COVID madness. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back. We were just talking, Jay, about the climate on the campus in the middle of the early days of COVID and the response. And that sort of sense of, not just estranging people and shutting them down, but actually threatening them and warning them not to speak. I mean, just... it's a bit like the Stasi thing. I mean, I know we've come out of this situation and a lot of people don't like to think about a lot of the terrible things that happened then. But I think in terms of knowing how to move forward and also as new things approach us, we don't allow those things to be forgotten. How did you just talk us through how you handled that and then what led on to you creating, co-founding the Great Barrington Declaration with Sunetra Gupta and Martin Kordoff?
Just briefly, I mean, I was filled with anxiety. I mean, I'd never been in a situation in summer of 2020 like this, where my own university effectively was telling me to stop talking. Although I have tenure, I felt like my job was threatened. I had to make a decision. The decision was like, if I stopped talking, I could go back to being a professor in good standing, and they would basically leave me alone. Or I could do what I felt like my job was, the thing I trained my entire life to do, which was to comment on health policy, to comment on, to do science around, infectious disease epidemiology, to actually just do the job that I trained to do. And I just thought I couldn't live with myself if I just stayed silent, Alan. And so I decided I was, whatever the consequences, I was going to keep speaking. In October of 2020, I had the opportunity to write with Martin Kulldorff of Harvard University and Sunetra Gupta of Oxford University, the Great Barrington Declaration. Great Barrington is a town in Western Massachusetts where we held a small meeting. And we spoke, it was a very short one-page declaration. I imagine you must have signed it, Alan. And the declaration says basically, let's follow the same plan we followed for 100 years of respiratory virus pandemics. Protect vulnerable people, move heaven and earth to protect vulnerable. We knew who the vulnerable people were with this. It was older people, people with multiple chronic diseases. Those were the people who were dying at high rates from infection. Whereas children and young people and younger people, even healthy middle-aged people, the risk was much lower than the risk from the lockdowns. Closing schools has harmed a generation of children, Alan, where basically the rest of their lives, they will feel the lack. Children will feel the lack of this one to two years of missed schooling. Around the world, the estimates were coming out in 2020 that 100 million people would be thrown into poverty. Tens of millions of people would starve. Much of that has actually come to pass, because when you disrupt the world's economy, it's really the poorest who pay the cost because you lose your job. You now make less than $2 a day of income. In Uganda is a good example of this. 4.5 million children missed 2 years of school, not online school, just gone, no school, and never came back to school. Many more just missed school altogether. And it turned out for many of the reasons why was that their families were so poor that they were sold into child labor, or worse, child marriage, or sold into prostitution. I mean, we have like just devastating stories of what happens when you essentially disrupt the world civilization, which is what we did, and we thought we did that in the name of health. So the Great Barrington Declaration called for lifting the lockdowns and then devoting resources in a focused way on protecting older vulnerable people.
And when it went round, a lot of people were very excited. You have an enormous amount of signatories, many in the medical profession and scientists. You know, often the retort when people were discussing policy was, are you a scientist? Are you an epidemiologist? Well, as you say, you know, with Sunetra, and many others that had signed up to this, there was a real concern. And this is the point, I think, that your already established pandemic responses were jettisoned. And that equally happened in the UK. I mean, it happened pretty much everywhere. I think Sweden was a bit of an outlier. And at one point, a few states that, you know, Florida and elsewhere took a different approach, maybe not so much from the get-go. But the question I think I want to ask you is, did people know, right? So if you think about the Diamond Princess as a Petri dish, I remember I was in New York at the time, and when that had happened and people were on there, and many of them were very old, and to talk about fatality rates, and as you yourself have said, the Great Barrington Declaration makes the point, you have shielding to protect the vulnerable and the elderly. I know that my uncle had got swine flu a few years earlier, actually in Florida, on the plane coming back, and he's got an autoimmune condition. So he was, and he's only a few years older than me, he's not my older brother, and he was in a coma because of the autoimmune, it really affected him badly. So I said to people that I was close to, even though I was very vocal about lockdowns and things like that, that obviously if you've got a seriously underlying health condition, this is an issue like something else like might be an issue for you, as opposed to for the general population, particularly, you know, for people that are under 70 and everything. But surely they knew and they could see the data, right? We saw what was happening there. We also, I know it's difficult to see data from China, but like you yourself had done, right? It was quite simple early on for anyone who was really interested in looking at that. So what happened? It's difficult to imagine that the most developed industrial nation in the world, with tech and brilliant, you know, mathematicians and physicians and all the best data available and the ability to process it and crunch it quickly, couldn't see this, right? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think the irony is that technology itself may have fueled the wrong response, right? In a couple of ways. Like, one is that the question, Alan, is why did we not shut down in 2020 during the swine flu in 2009? By the way, I'm sorry to hear about your uncle.
He's fully recovered. By the way, thank you. But he's fully recovered. But thank you.
Yeah, I mean, these are things to take seriously. Absolutely. But 2009. Why didn't we shut down the world? Why did we try to develop countermeasures very quickly, vaccines, treatments, but not disrupt the lives of the young. The reason is because back then we didn't have Zoom. Zoom enabled 20-30% of the Western population to face basically no harm, very little direct economic harm from the lockdowns. They didn't lose their jobs. That's not everybody, 20-30% of the population, but it's the 20-30% that control, governments, that control corporations, that are the richest, sort of the elite, the laptop class. That in a sense, the technology enabled us to do something extraordinary, lockdown, where we previously would not have done it before, that by not harming the elites. The other thing is that the idea that you can develop a vaccine so rapidly, we had a vaccine, from start to finish, it took essentially somewhere between 9 and 12 months to develop and test the vaccine at scale. At the beginning of the pandemic, I thought that such a feat would be impossible. The idea that that we did this, that it would be possible, was in the minds of many people in the pharmaceutical industry and inside government. And the prospect that, this countermeasure, this vaccine countermeasure, will be developed so rapidly, all we have to do is just wait it out and we'll get there, and that'll be better and safer. That's a technological triumph that led to a policy disaster. Right. Go ahead. Sorry, Alan.
No, carry on. Sorry.
Yeah. So the idea that the vaccine could happen itself led to the lockdown. The idea that if we just can hold on tight until keep the entire population safe until the vaccine is available. From one point of view, just an audacious gamble. What if the vaccine didn't end up working? Then we have lockdown for nothing. We've panicked the population for nothing. To some extent, that gamble paid off. Like, you have a vaccine that does protect. I think it's on the net benefit is probably good for older people, because even although it does have some severe side effects for a fraction of the population to take it, maybe one in 2,000, one in 10,000, something on that order. It's reduces the harm from COVID for that older population by quite a lot. For younger populations, the risk benefit ratio is very, very different.
There's a couple of things I want to unpack here with you, right? But the first point, I want to talk about the vaccine, but the first thing I want to say is, do you think what you said is that the question is, did they from the get-go think we'll have a lockdown and we'll implement these vaccines? Or were they – right. Yes, and so there wasn't a real – so that's different to them being in a state of shock and confusion and not knowing what to do. That's a very clear strategy you're saying you think they had from the get-go.
Yep, they had – so the vaccine candidate I think from the very earliest days of the pandemic, there was a vaccine candidate available, and world leaders were told that a vaccine is possible. It's just going to take 9 months to test it. Sometime in March of 2020, I think world leaders were told by science top scientists that it's possible to have a vaccine with very, very rapidly for this, within 9-12 months. And world leaders responded by shutting the world down.
Go on. I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but
no, Alan, please. Like, go ahead. What was your question?
Nine months is a very short time, particularly in terms of trials. Normally, we see things are 10 years. We understand there was let's say a big emergency, right? There's a pandemic. How much of this, I mean, I've spoken to various people on this, but about the mRNA technology and others, but this particular jab, and obviously there's a few different ones, right? They're different slightly between Moderna and Pfizer and others, but was 9 months enough time?
I mean, I think it depends on what goal you had in mind, right? So I think that 9 months, the trials that were conducted, essentially the patients were observed for maybe 2 or 3 months after the vaccine. And it's enough time, I think, to determine some things, but not other things. It's enough time, for instance, to determine, does the vaccine stop you from getting symptomatic infection? It might have also, if we run the trial on a much larger number of people, does the vaccine stop you from dying from COVID? By the way, the vaccine trials were not big enough to answer that question. It did determine that it stopped symptomatic infection for 2 months. That was what we learned from the trials. 95% efficacy against symptomatic infection. What we didn't check was, does the vaccine stop you from getting infected at all? Does the vaccine stop you from spreading the disease to others? The answer to that question turns out to be no. And especially, we didn't learn what happens after those 2 months. It in fact, the efficacy of the vaccine against getting disease and transmitting disease drops very sharply just around the 2, 3, 4 month point. That we didn't learn from the trials, because the trials were only run for 2 or 3 months. We didn't learn what was the full side effect profiles of these vaccines. For young men, it has a pretty high rate of myocarditis. I think somewhere in the order of 1 in 2, 1 in 3, 1 in 4,000. That's a very high serious adverse event rate. And for young men and for young women who are healthy, the benefit of the vaccine is quite low, because the harm from COVID is low to them. The death rate from COVID to them is quite low. So the risk-benefit ratio that we might have learned from a larger trial, we didn't learn. We learned that once we deployed the vaccine at scale in the population.
I mean, the thing is that I want to talk about the boosters as well, because also there's various trials, and some are just on mice and others. But the cost benefit analysis, which was never done in any of these things, it was never done in relationship to lockdown. It was never done in a which is why we've got so many of the consequences around the world. And you've spoken and written so much about what's happening in the developing world. It's often not discussed in the Western world, but we've had that. But also, the impacts and the side effects comparatively to any other procedure. I mean, your approach, the shielding, should surely be in the approach as well. If it was decided that something was going to be brought out so quickly with such limited data, and bear in mind, we only found out about much of this. We saw what was released about the trials, but we only found out about some of this because people were ordered to release that, and some of it was all redacted as well. But I mean, it wasn't like it was just out there in the public domain. There was a reluctance to do that. But the impacts to people below the age of 70, let's say the vulnerable age, or if you have underlying conditions and over 70, the cost-benefit analysis, as you say, and the impacts are far higher, the side effects we're seeing, aren't we, than with any other procedure, than would be permitted. And in the context of knowing, as many must have done at the time, I mean, you said, well, the problem is that there was too much data or too much technology. But my point was, knowing what the fatality rate was, knowing what the demographic who were most at risk was, and knowing how many people were actually getting ill and dying from this, what, in your mind, what was the reason why it was then pushed beyond people in the highly vulnerable categories everywhere?
It's the same era as at the beginning of the pandemic. The idea that everyone's equally at risk, or at least have a very high risk, and we all share in this together, right? This empathy that we can like figure out how to take care for each other. That idea was weaponized far beyond what the scientific evidence said. So in the context of the vaccine, the idea that, I actually celebrated, Alan, when the vaccine came out, because I thought, okay, we can use this for excellent focus protection for older people. Vaccinate older people, reduce their risk of COVID. You have some potential side effects, but the side effects seem less than the benefit from reducing the risk of COVID for older people. If we'd use the vaccine for focused protection, I think that that would have been a great policy. Instead, we decided that we were going to use the vaccine to effectively rid the world of COVID, reduce the spread of COVID to zero, on the false premise that the vaccine can stop transmission when it cannot. But that means if you think that the vaccine can stop transmission, that means everybody needs to get vaccinated. Even children as young as, you know, 6 months old need to get vaccinated. Literally everybody, regardless of whether for the individual the vaccination actually benefits them or not.
But why did they say, yeah, this is really good, Jay. But the question is, for anyone who's got any critical faculties, is all of these people, many of them, many smart, very smart. Why did they not, you say it's become weaponized, but who's making decisions here, right? It doesn't stop transmission.
I mean, it's public health officials advising governments. It's regulatory bodies that made these decisions in the absence of scientific evidence, sometimes in the face of contrary scientific evidence, to do this. You mentioned the boosters. I mean, the trials for the boosters, they didn't even check clinical outcomes. They checked intermediate endpoints like boosting antibodies, which don't correlate with long-term protection against getting infected. We made these decisions effectively blind. A lot of the government agencies that advise, scientific agencies advise the governments on this, made decisions based on the hope that the vaccine would stop transmission. That hope turned out to be false. And governments responded by these coercive force. If you don't get a vaccine, you can't participate in basic civil rights, civil life. If you don't get a vaccine, you lose your job. You can't travel. It was tremendous pressure put on by governments. Essentially, it created a two-class society, vaccinated, unvaccinated, clean and unclean.
I'm going to come back. I want to go deep down further on this. We've got to take a break. I'm Alan Miller. I'm with Jay Bhattacharya. We'll see you in just a minute. This is TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
It's not just who is Ray Epps anymore. There's a reason we call it the Fedsurrection. Defense attorneys for Dominic Pozzola, the Proud Boy on trial now in Washington, D.C., have disclosed that at least 40 law enforcement assets infiltrated not only Proud Boys, but other patriot groups that were present in D.C. on January 6, 2021. Indeed, videotape from patriot journalists like Bobby Powell have shown proof positive that law enforcement assets, undercover agents, were acting as agents provocateurs, were inciting the crowd to push through barricades, to climb the walls, to storm the Capitol. The justice that needs to come out of these January 6 trials is justice served on the Department of Justice and all the federal agencies and local law enforcement that incited a riot on January 6th. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
If you've taken meth, don't drive for at least 24 hours. If you've taken meth, don't drive for at least 24 hours. If you've taken meth, don't drive for at least 24 hours. If you've taken meth, don't drive for at least 24 hours. Even the smallest amount detected will cost your license. Drug drive and you'll get caught long after the high is gone. Think road safety. A message from the Government of South Australia.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. We were just in the thick of it. So much to talk about. Jay, with all of this that's happened with the vaccinations, and there's a few different ones, and we've seen that there's a range of things have happened. I mean, you know, we had a campaign that together with from the get-go to say children should never be vaccinated. They don't need it. There's no risk profile, even them getting COVID. So, and we had a lot of kind of, in the early days, quite a few people say things about us, and still some do when we're campaigning about things. They call us anti this or conspiracists or whatever. But I got a question for you, because you've always seemed very, very, you're very rational. You're very measured. You're very balanced. Many people were now calling for this to be paused and impacted. Now, obviously, to your point, lots of people have had COVID already and have built up immunity, and there's been all sorts of discussions, and we haven't got the time to do a real deep dive just on that, on how much they influence even you catching it again afterwards or anything. But in your opinion, should it be paused now, this whole procedure? Because it was brought in emergency measures. There are side effects, albeit they might be small, but that's small in terms of numbers. But if you're one of the small people, statistically, over the hundreds of millions of people have taken it, there's many people that have got side effects. Here in Britain, we've had people that many of them haven't been paid out yet, and many more are being ignored. But what's your view on this? Do you think it should be paused, it should be stopped, it should be just allowed for certain groups? What's your thoughts?
I mean, I think partly just to set the background for the answer to my question, that question, because such a large fraction of the population have already had COVID and recovered, the marginal benefit of the vaccine is smaller than it once was. Let me just unpack that. If you've had COVID and recovered, you have quite good immunity. Getting the vaccine there's no direct evidence in terms of a trial for this, but it looks like it might reduce your risk of dying from COVID a little bit. Even if you're older, if you recover from COVID, you have excellent immunity already. But the vaccine on the margin might help a little bit. The marginal benefit is much lower than it once was because so much of the population already is vaccinated. Or so much of the population has already had COVID and recovered, right? So you just widespread immunity. We're no longer immune naive population. So the stakes are much lower than they once was. As you say, Alan, I think the serious adverse event rate is actually, I mean, you know, it's higher than most other vaccines in widespread use. It's maybe somewhere in the order of 1 in 1,000 for serious adverse events, some very, very serious adverse events resulting in hospitalizations, and so maybe even deaths, maybe, you know, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000, 1 in, you know, maybe on that order, 100,000. I mean, you know, there's a lot of dispute in the literature about this. But in any case, too high for something where there's a marginal benefit small. Now, as far as pausing, again, I go back to the principle of focus protection. I think there are still a few people who might benefit from it. So I'm uncomfortable using the word pause because I want to reserve a doctor that says, looks at you and says, look, for you, the clinical benefit is worth the risk. I want the doctor to be able to say that. So I don't like the word pause here. What I will say is that a widespread recommendation that everybody get the vaccine essentially by force, I think that is not wise. Certainly for younger people, people under the age of 50, most people under the age of 50 will not need the vaccine. I do want it available in the toolkit of physicians for particular patients who are high risk. I'm not particularly fond of the word pause here, but I don't think that it should be a public health campaign. It should be something left to a physician and a patient.
You know, you were talking earlier about the vaccine mandate and mandating this, and it was incredible to me to witness what was going on in America and in New York in particular, in certain states that historically I've always seen, and they sort of present themselves, particularly New York City, as being a place full of freedom and, you know, sort of independent choice and liberties. And to see the enthusiastic implementation, as you know, Mayor Cuomo the Governor Cuomo, as we've seen lots of measures and mistakes and everything, but to see the wholesale take up of vaccine passports and mandates, and in fact also to see that you still needed to have two of the old vaccines, because when we keep saying the vaccine, but obviously boosters are different and some people are getting boosters all the time. My mum's sick, right? And she's got a condition and she's had several, and I've asked her to stop having them because I'm not convinced they're doing worse things to her at this point than her actual condition. And if she gets it, that's our concern, you know, with the boosters. But that's my opinion, obviously, based on what I'm seeing at the moment. But how is it that America, land of the free, I mean, I know there's a history of mandating things, which, you know, we could talk about, but that this rule was in place for anyone who's not a citizen, and even it was presented to citizens at the time that they needed to have two to travel, as it happens. What was going on there with this mandate? Why is that in place? I know it's being contested, but what happened?
I mean, it's still the case that foreign visitors cannot come enter the United States if they're not vaccinated. It makes absolutely no epidemiological sense. The United States is one of the only countries in the West that still has such a policy. It's just a shame on the United States, a black mark on the United States, that we are not welcoming foreign visitors who are not vaccinated. It's just discrimination for no purpose. I don't really have an answer. Like the politics of the pandemic are so strange to me, Alan. You have a socialist Sweden, social democratic Sweden that had a very reasonable freedom-loving policy that protected vulnerable older people, and the result, they have lower all-cause excess deaths than basically the whole rest of the world. The United States, the blue states, it's California, it's New York that impose some of the most draconian restrictions, and the vaccine mandates, it's just pure discrimination. I mean, I think people were just out of their minds. I mean, they just, and I, you know, maybe part of it is these like the California and New York are house a large part of the American elite, that the laptop class that didn't suffer so much from the lockdowns and restrictions. But it became almost this, like, you know, families were divided against each other, where, you know, if you're for Christmas dinner, you don't invite the people that are unvaccinated. You shun them, right? That's what happened in 2021. It is a tragic result of this public health messaging that if you don't take the vaccine, you are being unempathic to others, because the vaccine is necessary to keep you clean, to protect your grandma. It's the same error that we talked about at the beginning of this hour, if I don't keep myself careful and isolated, I'm going to harm grandma. I mean, it's the same kind of messaging sort of carried forward, applied in the vaccine era.
Yeah. So you we're coming to the end of the hour, and I'm gutted, because this, I always love talking to you. There's so much more to discuss, but just, I mean, firstly, all of this was going on, and then we discover through the Twitter files what perhaps many of us knew, but like, you had a specific targeting, a blacklisting, shadow banning, censoring, and very senior, higher ranking people saying that, you know, not to discredit you. Just tell us a bit about that, how it came about and what that's all meant.
So, I mean, I've seen this from two ends. So on the one hand, through various machinations, I was invited to go visit Twitter headquarters in December of 2022, and I met with Elon Musk. They showed me the internal, essentially, database for my Twitter account. I joined Twitter in September of 2021. It turns out the day I joined, I was placed on a blacklist. Blacklist made me think, allowed me to tweet, but made sure that my tweets were only seen by my immediate followers and nobody else, or very few other people. The question is, why was I placed on a blacklist? I mean, normally, you wouldn't expect a private company like Twitter, that whose job is to, like, let people communicate with each other, to blacklist a professor of medicine or a professor from Stanford University. So why would they do that? I'm also involved in a lawsuit brought by the Missouri and Louisiana Attorney General's offices against the Biden administration. In that lawsuit, what we found, based on depositions of people like Tony Fauci and a dozen other federal agents from across the federal government, we found that there was a vast campaign across the U.S. federal government to control the speech of Americans on Twitter, and not just Americans. On social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Google, to essentially enforce COVID orthodoxy. So if you, for instance, said that a natural immunity, that people who'd had COVID and recovered had pretty good immunity, think something I just said on this podcast or this radio show, you would get censored. You'd get blacklisted. Often you didn't even know that you were blacklisted. You see, we have emails from the White House essentially threatening Facebook that if they didn't do that kind of blacklisting, that their legal protections would be undermined, that their company would be destroyed. It was a government action that led to the censorship and suppression of scientific discussion online.
And so, I mean, quickly, how did that make you feel, and what has happened since then? And tell us also about the court case, please.
I mean, I can't believe that it happened. I had this, I guess, naive vision of the United States as of a land where the right to free speech was sacrosanct. I mean, that's the assumption, the guiding assumption I'd lived with my entire life. To see the government act in this way, this authoritarian way, it just felt like I feel like I don't live in the United States anymore. We just need to reform that. The court case, this Missouri versus Biden case, is still ongoing, but we've survived a motion to dismiss, and we are now requesting a preliminary injunction to end the censorship. This sort of censorship industrial complex that the government has set up. So we'll see if we win that. I have very high hopes. The judge that in dismissing the government's motion to dismiss the case wrote a 77-page brief where you could see the shock in his writing about what the government has done. The idea that the United States government should inject itself into the free speech of Americans in online settings is absolutely contrary to the First Amendment of the United States. It is against the basic norms of American society for the government to suppress online speech or any speech in that way that isn't like directly threatening we're not committing fraud, or we're not like trying to like put child porn out. What we're trying to do here is have a scientific discussion, have a health policy discussion, to have the United States government work to suppress that, to put their thumb on the scale, to essentially to delegitimize people who disagree with lockdowns, with vaccine mandates, with the idea that there's no immunity after COVID recovery. That is just shocking. It is absolutely shocking. It should shock every single person that cares about free speech, that cares about freedom.
It is shocking.
It
I think the thing
about good health policy outcomes.
Well, indeed, and the idea that science can only really be science if it's contested and challenged, and also if the people that who are arguing a position should be happy and excited to explain the merit and the value of their position and their idea, and to show it to everyone why it's so robust, rather than shutting that discussion down. I mean, we've also seen in Britain that we've had the government and DCMS and others have had spy units on citizens, the shadow banning across social media. And now, of course, we've got the online safety bill. Actually, Elon Musk has been subject to the European version of that, which means that free speech can be curtailed. We have an online, and he signed it. I mean, it's done already. I mean, we've been curtailed. And there's an argument that the government here wants to outsource censorship to big tech and say that, you know, you've got your terms and conditions, you handle it, otherwise we'll fine you enormous amounts of money. How do you see moving forwards? You're obviously looking at it from the point of view of your work and everything, but obviously this whole experience has impacted everyone. It's brought so many people together. There's been so many damages. We've got cost of living, cost of lockdown crisis. We've got inflation, we've got, you know, harms in education and health and across the board that's going to be long lasting. How, coming out of this, and no, free speech is obviously a key thing and us being able to do it, what would you say are the real takeaways for the future, and how we can insist that, let's just talk briefly, we know that like the WHO have got the independent health regulation, international health regulations, the amendments going through, I think it's April 17th in about a week's time, 10 days time. That obviously has an influence with the world. What do you think is really vital that we learn and we insist on and we make sure happens?
So I've worked on a document with seven other epidemiologists and scientists called the Norfolk Group, N-O-R-F-O-L-K, G-R-O-U-P, norfolkgroup.org document. It's a blueprint for an honest commission asking basic questions about our pandemic response in a whole bunch of areas, many of which we discussed during this this last hour, Alan. I think there has to be a commission to evaluate, just like when there's an airplane crash. There's people independent of the crash do an evaluation of the actions of the people that were involved in it. And then from that, reform happens. I think that is absolutely essential. But what I'm seeing happen in the UK and other places is, even if there is a commission, very often it's led by the people who made these mistakes, these hugely consequential decisions, and they essentially whitewash it. We need an honest commission to actually look at to answer the questions that are in that Norfolk Group blueprint, and then based on that, reform our public health system so a disaster like this never happens again.
Ray, I'm posting that, the Norfolk Group.org. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll definitely be speaking to you more. Thank you for your contribution, for your bravery, for your pursuing of things and not kowtowing to those that would shut you down. We've got a debt that we all owe you, and we really appreciate it. Jay Bhattacharya, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Alan.